Guten Tag, everybody. Or should we say good morning? It is day 10. We've made it to double figures here in the Euros. And it is a beautiful day here in Cologne. Blue skies, fluffy clouds, temperature is high. Finally, the Kaiser weather has arrived. Everybody's out. People are wearing shorts, t-shirts, a lot of smiles. This is what we expected from Euro 2024 in terms of the weather. Just like in World Cup 2006, the weather cooperated throughout, and this is our first gorgeous day. So, unfortunately, the credential gods did not smile on me, and I got given a knockback to the Germany-Switzerland game in Frankfurt. So, without the pressures of having to get trains and work out travel, and to be fair, I would have gone back at about 3 o'clock in the morning. So, yeah, a little relieved, to be honest with you. So I've decided to go to Bochum, where my friend Oliver Hintz is the senior producer for a quiz show. But before going to Bochum later on in the day, it was time to explore Cologne. So I did what every great tourist does and rented myself a bicycle. The great thing is bikes are available throughout the city. They're so easy to rent. They're so cheap to rent. And so I got myself a nice little traveler and rode along the river, which was quite beautiful, before heading into town and Heumark for the Fan Fest, where the media center is. And well, after a 3 mile bike ride, you can imagine I was a little puffy, a little sweaty, so treated myself to a couple of ice cold Radlers. Really is quite a delicious drink, and only like 2.2% alcohol or something like that, so no chance of getting hammered. And then continued around the old city, and of course taking the cathedral, which is the central attraction in Cologne. It is in fact the most visited landmark in Germany. Over 6 million people a year go see it. It's the tallest twin-spire church in the world. And got a great story, really. Started construction in 1248 and completed in 1880. That's a long time to build a cathedral, but to be fair, it is really spectacular. Also went past the largest brothel in Europe. Pasha is its name, big pink building. Of course, I didn't go in, but looked from the outside. Looked fairly interesting. And yeah, it was just beautiful. Parks are packed. There's so much greenery. Cologne really is a super city to get around. You don't need a car, which is absolutely fantastic. Bars and restaurants everywhere. Went to a great little bakery, and the bakeries, I mean, you would love these places. I mean, the rolls, the pretzels, the cakes, and it's all so cheap, so fresh, so tasty that you're never going to go hungry, to be fair. I think I have put on a few pounds, yikes, with all the bread rolls I've been eating. Anyway, we got back to my place about 5, and then off we went to Bochum. Ollie was driving at like 10 million miles an hour, which you can do on the Autobahn. We were just in a tiny little Fiat. The really cool thing is you can rent cars on the street. You know, there's this app, and yeah, you open up the app, you see where a car is available, type in the numbers, and the car kind of opens up, and away you go. So we went to Bochum in this little Fiat 500, and Ollie was driving about 170 Ks, which felt very quick and pretty scary. On the way there, past the Bayer Leverkusen ground, and it really was, you know, it's quite impressive. So it's on the side of the freeway. But what's even more impressive is Leverkusen is absolutely dominated by the plant. I mean, this plant, it's chemicals and pharmaceuticals. It seems to take up the entire city. Obviously, Leverkusen, funded by Bayer, and just coming off a great season. Xavi Alonso, unbeaten in the Bundesliga. The first time a team has ever gone an entire season unbeaten. They are the new Invincibles. Congratulations to Leverkusen and Xavi. So we get to Bochum. Bochum's a very tiny town, really. Want to call it a city. And showed up at this bar where, I got to say, I was really impressed. There was two mobile trucks, a lot of support staff for a show that went out on Twitch during the game, during the Germany-Switzerland game, and then a big quiz show afterwards. Although they did do some questions during the game. And I had a chance to catch up with the bar owner and a couple of supporters to get their thoughts on, you know, the German national team, about the bar, which had been around for something like 65 years, and get a real taste of local Germany. Both of them big fans. Well, one of them was a big fan of Bochum. The other one was Borussia Dortmund. And incredible. He told me that pays €300 for a season ticket for the Yellow Wall. Now, let that sink in. €300 for the season to stand in the Yellow Wall. And the beer is like €3, not $18. So, lots to recommend German football. But stand by and let's have a listen to... I do apologize ahead of time. It was a busy bar and the audio isn't the greatest. But if you stick with it, there's some good stuff there. The owner of the bar.
Hey, I'm Dirk and I'm owner of the Kuhin.
So we're in this little bar right now. It's very cool. Looks like you're going to have a sports quiz. How did this come about?
Well, actually, in January, we received a mail from the production company, and they just said we're scouting bars all over Germany. And we said, yes, come over, show them the place. And after a few weeks and a few talks, they said, yeah, let's do it in Bochum.
So I'm looking around the bar, and there's a lot of football memorabilia. How long has it been a football pub?
So the pub itself is about 50 years old already. We reopened it after Corona in 3 years ago. And yeah, it's a football club. So actually, we only open for the Bundesliga games from the VfL Bochum.
And so Bochum are a club that's gone up and down, up and down. What's it like being a big fan of Bochum and living the roller coaster?
Well, it's as I said, it's real fandom, as I would say it. So because it's not just you are not always successful like Munich or Dortmund. And actually, you see when you go to the second league and then back to the first league, you actually see who are real fans and who are guys who just come to see Dortmund, Bayern, and the other. Yeah.
And when we look at the ownership of German clubs, the model is very different than elsewhere. Around the footballing world, really. Talk to us about the ownership model and what it means to you fans.
Well, I mean, you talk about the 50 plus one rule, yeah, in Germany. What I think the fans really say, it's still, the club is still from the fans. You know, it's different when you have an owner who's, I don't know, in Arabia or wherever from. And that, I think, makes a lot about the culture in the club itself, because you just feel it's still the club of the fans. Yeah, it's,
if you were to compare 2024 to 2006, what are the differences and what are the similarities?
Well, I think the difference is, we've done it before, so the last tournament was in 88, I think, so people like me can't remember anything, so 2006 was the first big tournament for me in Germany. The atmosphere is quite still good and still the same, though 2006 was special because it was the first time the whole world looked Germany for the tournament in my generation. And I think I still believe we also had back in 2006 we had quite a good team. We have it now. So there are people who are now world champions already in the team, which is a big difference because back in 2006 you had the Schweinsteiger, Podolski guys who knew up and coming, and now you have the Ed Musiala, like, you know, the young hungry guys with some veterans. So yeah, I think we can go far with friends together.
And you have one of the youngest coaches in the tournament. In fact, I think the youngest coach in the tournament. How do you think he's done, and what do you think his qualities are?
Well, first of all, I think Julian Nagelsmann is an absolute expert in modern football. So, and I think he showed that in the clubs he coached already. And I think because he's quite young, he talks the language of the players, which is an advantage. Well, on the other hand, you look at the Champions League. See, Ancelotti works also when you're a bit older and needs more experience. But I do believe he can get the spirit in the team with the right words, find the right words for the generation.
And here we are in Balkan. Who are your biggest rivals? What's it like when you play against them?
Well, in Bobby, as you would say, it's Schalke 04 and Borussia Dortmund, because it's just a 10-minute drive from here. Though the big derby, to be honest, is Schalke Dortmund, yeah, you have to say it. So that's the derby we play. And yeah, it's a special atmosphere in derbies. Yeah? It's all in the rural area. You feel the whole week, the vibe, the derby's coming. And after the derby, when you win, you go to work on Monday in a different way than you, like you won against Wolfsburg or something. Yeah?
I mean, do you feel spoiled? Because I'm driving up with my friend Oli from Cologne, and it dawned on me there's 10 clubs within a stone's throw of each other. So every week you get a chance to have incredible football here in the Bundesliga.
Yeah, definitely. So you can go to, you know, Cologne, Düsseldorf, and also you have some, I would say, like sleeping giants like Rot-Weiß Essen is a very famous club. Bad Schandelneuen was here. So yeah, it's that's the rural area. So many cities, so many people live here. It's the most crowded area in Germany where people live. It's great when you're a football guy. So sometimes I have friends coming over for football weekend, and we go to 3 or 4 different matches in the first, second, and third league. Yeah.
There is no doubt, fandom in Germany is something very, very special. So the results: Germany got the tie. Lucky Germany. They always seem to find a way, and spoiled it for me really, because if they finished second, they would have gone to Berlin, which is where I'm heading on Saturday. Scotland, of course, lost in the last minute of the game, in the longest game in the history of the Euros, for a 90-minute game, 10 minutes of extra time. I did have a chance to chat with this Scottish journalist about the woes of Scottish football and why perhaps it has suffered so much over the last 20 years. Because all you have to do is go back to the late 70s and early 80s, and some of the Scottish teams were littered with world-class players. So this is quite interesting and also quite sad. So check it out.
My name is Graham Crozer, and I'm a freelance sports writer.
Now, not wanting to be rude and offend you immediately, Scotland seemed very limited. But what Scotland did do is they worked their bollocks off. And I think that work rate, I think that's one of the main qualities of the team.
It's always one of the main qualities of any Scottish team. But I think you do a slight disservice to Billy Gilmour and Callum McGregor at the base of the Scottish midfield.
I was talking to some of the older fans outside the stadium yesterday. And I mean, I think I might be a bit older than you. So, and harking back to 1978 and the Soonesses and the Dalgleishes and the Rioks, why don't Scotland produce players like that anymore?
Oh, that's a whole other question. It's a good question. I think it's probably more a case that the game's moved on and we've not kept up. So I would guess a lot of those raw qualities are still there in certain players, but you know, there have been a lot of technical advancements in the game. Maybe our game has rested in its laurels a little bit over time. Maybe there's not been the right investment in the game. Maybe our domestic clubs have looked to foreign shores for players a little bit too much in the intervening years as well. I think there's a whole myriad of reasons for that.
So, staying in the past, because I guess that's where I am, I remember the day in the Premiership where every other manager was a Scotsman. How come they were so successful in those 80s and 90s and maybe the early 2000s, and yet now we don't see Scottish managers so much anymore?
Again, maybe the game's moved on.
What do you mean by that, though, the game has moved on? Because game is the game, right? It's always been 11v11. It's played on this 120x75. How does it move on and leave a country behind?
I think the managers you mentioned there, so say you go back, you talk about Ferguson, you talk about George Graham and guys like that. I think a lot of it, not all of it, but they will be fear to a certain extent. I don't think that washes with players anymore. You need far more in your armoury than that. I think David Moyes has done rather well over the last few years, delivering a European trophy to West Ham. I think the way he was treated was a little bit shabby, if I'm being honest. So he's one who's modernised. Alex Ferguson did famously manage to regenerate his team two or three different times. So I think that potential's there for sure. But I think the game everywhere across the world has moved on. And maybe we haven't. Maybe we were punching above our weight all those years, whether it was players, whether it was managers. So we are a small country.
Definitely a small country, but a production line of great players and great managers in the past. How does Scotland reinvent itself?
I don't know. I guess that goes right down to the academies in the country. I think there is also a difficulty in that Scotland's next door to England, and it's an easy route for English clubs to come and cherry pick the best. And again, if you players can get lost in the systems at these big clubs, whether it's Chelsea, Man City or whatever. So I think that's an issue. I think minutes at an early age is key to development for any young player. Or maybe we would benefit from a bigger league. Our domestic top flight's 12 teams at the moment. If you pushed it up to 16, I think it would give it more breathing space, might make managers more inclined to give youth a chance. Whether that would encourage the best players to stay, I don't know. The money on offer in England is still so rich. But I think there maybe are things, there maybe is scope for us to do that, but that would depend on the clubs in the top flight at the moment voting for that new structure, and I'm not sure they're inclined to do that, to share the... Well, it's a fairly small pie anyway, to share it around more clubs. I'm not sure there's a will or the appetite to do that at the moment.
So you mentioned the league, and of course, you know, the league is dominated by Celtic and Rangers. Obviously, you're a Scotsman to your core, but how would you feel if Celtic and Rangers maybe joined the Premiership in England?
I think there'd be mixed emotions in that one, because you want your elite clubs to stay and your flagship clubs to stay in your country. I think it would definitely, obviously, it would ventilate the league and the cups. You saw when Rangers, you know, were forced to start again at the bottom tier, you know, suddenly the winners of the cup competitions were a lot more varied. Celtic dominated in league terms, but you know, you had, you know, other teams, Hearts had a shot, Hibs had a shot, other clubs working, St Mirren won a cup, you know, there was a chance for other teams to come and compete. When Rangers and Celtic are there, invariably one or the other's going to reach the final. And then it's really hard. So we'd prefer if they stayed, but if there was a way maybe to bridge the gap for the big city clubs like Aberdeen, Hearts, Hibs, and even the Dundee clubs maybe, some kind of mechanism to bring them just a little bit closer. But again, you're not going to get the big two while they're trying to compete in Europe to allow themselves to get pulled back, if you like, the domestic competition. So I don't know. I think that's difficult. I think Scottish football is quite unique in that sense. There's two massive super clubs in one city, and there's nothing really in between, down to Hearts and Hibs, you know. So yeah, it's just a bit lopsided. It's always been like that, and I'm not sure what you do about it.
Well, I'm gonna go back into history again. I remember the days of Aberdeen and Dundee United being really good in Europe. In fact, Aberdeen won the Cup Winners' Cup most famously. Why did these clubs not continue their growth?
Well, Aberdeen lost Alex Ferguson to Manchester United, which is probably the start. I think at that point, you see, Ferguson left for Manchester United, I think, around about 86. That's roughly when Graham Souness came into Rangers. And suddenly cash became king at that point. Aberdeen and Dundee United at that point famously held on to their players for the majority of their careers, long contracts. You didn't argue with the manager when he put down a four-year contract in front of you and said, you're staying. Alex McLeish, Willie Miller, Jim Leighton did go to Manchester United eventually. These players, they wouldn't hang around long enough to build that kind of dynasty at an Aberdeen anymore. I think that's impossible. I think those days have gone. A new model has to come up for these clubs, and you know, probably it would be a recruitment model where you buy low and sell high. None of them have quite managed to pull that trick off yet. But you see it in other, there are comparable clubs in other countries, I think, that managed to do that. But again, the problem is it's so lopsided in Scotland. Celtic and Rangers are so far ahead that, yeah. I don't know is the answer to your question, so sorry to ramble on there.
I mean, really fascinating stuff to hear that about Scottish football. And, the Scots are going home. They won't be in the Euros anymore. And I'm going home. So that's day 10 put to bed. Tomorrow, back off to Dusseldorf. and Spain taking on Albania. Spain having already qualified. Albania on life support. Should be a Spain victory, right? But you never know. Until tomorrow, bye for now.